Hi, I'm Gabby Logan, and this is the II Family Money Show. In each episode, I speak to a famous face about the role money has played in their family life and professional success. I'll also get some practical tips from an expert to help you get to grips with your finances. In this episode, I'm joined by TV presenter Rachel Riley. Rachel's co-hosted long-running Channel 4 puzzle show Countdown since 2009, as well as its comedy spin-off 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown. She also appeared on the 2013 series of Strictly Come Dancing, where she met her pro dancer husband and dad to their two daughters, Pasha Kovalev. Away from our screens, Rachel has just published her first maths book, At Sixes and Sevens, How to Understand Numbers and Make Maths Easy, which aims to give confidence to adults who struggle with maths and make the subject more accessible. In our interview, Rachel tells me how she switched from being a self-confessed maths geek at Oxford University to a TV presenter, why she believes numeracy can have a huge impact on people's lives, and the very different approaches she and her husband Pasha have towards money. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I was so excited when I heard that you'd agreed to come and chat to us, because you are the perfect person to talk to, really, in this area, because investment finance, financial planning, all kind of comes down to your understanding, I think, of kind of numeracy and money and having a sense of kind of the value of things. So go back to your childhood for us, will you? And just tell us a little bit about your early years when it came to kind of understanding numeracy, because you make it look fun. Was it always fun as a kid?
Well, I think it can be fun if you turn it into a game. And my mum tells me ad infinitum, the story of when I was 4 years old and I used to have this little 80s style computer that I carried around, and you had to do the sums, you know, really basic sums, but as many as possible within a certain amount of time. And I just love that. And I think maths is one of those subjects that if you're good at it and you get this tick, you get this buzz when you get the right answer. And I got that at a really early age, and people told me I was good, and I felt like I got an inordinate amount of praise for something that I found relatively easy. And growing up now and trying to, you know, promote numeracy, I can see how the counter side of that, if you're not numerate, if you're not confident with numbers and you get told at a really early age you're not a maths person or it's not for you, then you can switch off to it, which I think is really detrimental to both the individual who gets told that and, you know, society as a whole, we need more numerate people.
And at home also, school is one thing and having a teacher that is brilliant and engaging. And then at home, if your parents have had an experience like that and they're not that into maths and numeracy, then they're not going to necessarily encourage you. But your mum did, didn't she? She was, or your family were quite nurturing when it came to numeracy.
Yeah, they were nurturing when it came to education. My parents didn't know the area where we're living. Neither of them were from Essex where I was brought up. So they sent me to, you know, what they thought was a good school, which was a good school. And we had test exams at the end of every year. And mum would be there, you know, with me and my brother testing us on stuff. And, you know, again, it's that buzz of getting things right as a kid. And hopefully that's what I want to instill into my children, that an enjoyment of learning, because you've got to do it. So if you enjoy something, you're going to want to do it more, you mean make more effort. Unfortunately, in the numbers department, I didn't have to make as much effort. I was just kind of, I had a couple of really great teachers that I remember, you know, one particularly in year five who saw something in me and gave me extra stuff. And I remember in year three, it was too easy. So my mum stormed into school and said, you know, my daughter needs to do more than 2+5 and 5+2. And you need to stretch kids. And I think there's a fine balance when it comes to maths of making it too easy. So the most talented kids will switch off, whereas you should extend them and push them, or making it too difficult. And then you feel like you're listening to a foreign language for kids who are struggling, because everybody needs that firm foundation of understanding where the numbers come from, how math works, and because it doesn't come out of nowhere. And if you have that firm foundation, then you can build upon it. And if you don't, you know, you might as well be sitting in a Japanese lesson for, you know, the next 11 years of your schooling, because you can't build on something that's not there to start with.
And I think also it's understanding and seeing possibilities from maths, isn't it? Why, well, obviously, I know I need to get through life. I need to know how to add up. I need to know that I'm not being shortchanged. I need to know that, you know, I can pay my bills. But where maths can take you as a career is absolutely kind of, you know, there's no end, is there, to the possibilities.
Yeah.
And also, it's not a subject that necessarily means, well, you do maths, you can't be good at the arts or creative. So,
right.
You know, look at Leonardo da Vinci,
yeah.
You know. So you have possibilities in so many areas, which sometimes doesn't come across, I think.
Yeah, I think maths is one of those subjects. It's probably the most requested subject for university courses, because, of course, you know, across geography, across all the sciences, across all the medicines, you know, there's barely a subject you can mention that doesn't require some level of maths. And, you know, there are some some statistics, obviously, they come out every few years, of the more money you're potentially going to earn, the more employable you are. Even some surprising things like mental health. Your mental health is more likely to be good if you're good at maths. And on the counter to that, it's less likely to be good if you're not very numerate. And it even has specific implications in terms of health outcomes. So numbers really does set you up for life. If you're a numerate person, you can pretty much use those skills, you know, in your work, in your home life, in your finances, helping your kids with their homework. It's going to be with you for the rest of your life, and you're going to find it useful.
So did you study pure maths at university? Was that your degree?
I did. It was just called maths. All right. So when I was applying for university, I was applying for maths with theoretical physics everywhere, except Oxford, who didn't do that. It was just maths. And then you specialise in stuff. So I did all the applied stuff. So I did quantum computing, quantum mechanics. I did maths of the mathematical biology and maths of the environment. So we're looking at how you model the environment and climate change using mathematical models, how you look at the body and how cancers grow using mathematical models. So I really like the useful maths, where you can see, you know, and over the years, people invented maths. Pure mathematicians invented, discovered, whichever side of the debate you are. And then, you know, decades later, they find what physical entity it fits onto as new discoveries in science come forward. And I find that fascinating. And I think there are two distinct types of mathematicians. The people that love the beauty of an equation and, you know, all that kind of stuff, all that junk, I'm not interested in. if you can recite pi to 13 million, whatever, decimal places, good for you. But it doesn't float my boat. I really like the nuts and bolts of, you know, working things out for yourself and using that math to describe things in the real world.
So you do all of that and you go to Oxford, and then at the age of 23, you didn't do the course about countdown. I didn't hear you say that.
You can there was sound no like course Jimmy Carr now.
No, tell me how you kind of made that decision, because I imagine you wrestled a bit with that. Like, you know, you've got this incredible education and this brain, then you could do loads of different things, but also this tantalising prospect of doing this iconic maths show. In Countdown.
I've watched Countdown since I was a kid, so. You know, go back to the childhood, I'd get home from school and at 4 o'clock it was 15 to one and 4:30 it was Countdown. I used to watch with my little brother, and I love the numbers game. I'm just a puzzle geek. That's what I enjoy. And I finished uni in the June, and I was applying for loads of different grad jobs, and most of them, you know, the application forms were like a novel. You know, when have you worked in a team? When have you tied your shoelaces on a Monday? Like everything they want to know. And this one was 50 words and a photo. For Countdown. And, you know, I never thought there was a job at the end of it. It never clicked that it was a real tangible thing. I just thought, well, I'll apply for it because it's, you know, why not? And didn't expect to hear back. And, you know, 13 years later, still going. And I just thought, I didn't know if I could do it, but they thought I could do it. They wanted to give me the job. So trust them. And if it all goes pear-shaped, then I've got my degree to fall back on, which, you know, one day I'm just waiting for that degree to fall back on.
But you didn't have, through university, a desire necessarily to be on TV. Burning desire.
Never. I mean, I was a maths geek at uni. I spent my time cycling around playing football, netball, hockey, you know, never out of dreadful clothes.
Sports gear,
you know, everything covered in my Oriel college stash. And I didn't do any drama presentation, anything useful for my job at all. So I've had to learn it all as I've gone. And thankfully, you know, when I got my job in 2008, I got it, you know, there was no such social media. So it's kind of a bit more of a gentle entry into the world of presenting and learning your trade.
You were just on the edge of social media, weren't you? Yeah, because I think Twitter was, you know, kind of becoming kind of something about a couple of years later. I would say that as well. I started out when there was no social media. I think it would have been very different being a woman in football if I'd had to look at social media all the time. So you had that in your mind, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll fall back. It has worked out beautifully, obviously, and there's Cats Does Countdown, there's 8 out of 10, there's Strictly Where You Met Your Husband, and I'm sure many, many other opportunities. But essentially, you work in a world which is, you know, you're at the whim of other people's kind of view of you, aren't you? And it's whether or not, well, I don't, you know, I like this person, I don't like that person. Mm-hmm. Do you feel secure in that? Because it's almost freelance, isn't it? It's almost like being a freelancer.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's been, especially, you know, I've had some trials and tribulations in the most recent few years. And, you know, it's a strange thing that your popularity is, you know, your currency, really, because you have to be... Mm. like to be booked onto shows to get work. And, you know, at times it can be stressful. And I think it's a social media thing. And I've got, you know, two little girls now. And I think what it's going to be like for them as teenagers with this kind of pressure. But I'm lucky that I've got, you know, great family and my husband, and who's also in the industry, but ignores all of it. Just is so, you know, immune. Just washes over him all of this stuff. And I think I take a leaf out of his book and just try and, you know, I think everything in life, even when I was doing a maths degree at Oxford, people would say, oh, only maths. Like, you're not doing, you know, Japanese and German at the same time. So you can't please all the people. And I think you just, you know, on social media, you get the same outfit you're wearing. Someone will tell you it's the worst thing they've ever seen. And the next person's, where can I buy this thing? So you just have to kind of tune out other people, I think, and answer to yourself. And that's all you can do.
Because it's interesting, maths is such a definite subject, isn't it? There is a right answer to things. There's nobody saying, well, it could be 5 or it could be 8. You know, it's a definite thing. And the career that the industry that we both work in is obviously a little bit more nebulous. And there's not like, you know, there's not a career route or a path to kind of get to where you want to be. It's not like starting out an accountancy firm and working your way up to being a partner. So it is also... financially, you know, you can have great years. Mm-hmm. Financially, you can have years that are kind of, you know, slightly down a bit. So in terms of when it comes to planning, are you quite good at that? Are you quite careful and sensible?
In some respects, you get, I think, option paralysis. Because you're not, you know, I've got, most of my friends are all really sensible. They're all working for companies. They have been for a long time. And some of them are, you know, spreading their wings and going up themselves now. But they've all had, you know, the company pension that's kind of, you know, there, and you just, it's easy. There's one option, you pay into it and your employer pays in. And I, because I've been on with various different companies and various different ways of being paid, it's just kind of, it's a bit different. It's a little bit trickier. And I definitely need to get better, especially now I've got girls. And I think with the babies, it kind of focuses your mind and makes you a bit more forward thinking. But then again, you know, the pandemic came in and you just can't count on anything. In this industry, especially, I was grateful that Countdown continued, but nothing else did, obviously, around the country for everyone for a long time. But I'm probably more risk averse end of financial stuff. And I like to have, you know, a nest egg sitting there. There's no way I'd spend all my money.
So have you got a certain amount that you always in your mind know is there just in case of, you know, things kind of going wrong?
I think you have to. And, you know, from my upbringing, my dad's from Salford, and I think that's, you know, his upbringing. He was the first one in his family to go to uni. They didn't have loads of money. He takes cornflakes with him when he goes on holiday, much to my mum's dismay.
Embarrassment.
Yeah, big box of cornflakes, in case you can't buy them there. So yeah, they've you know, my mum, she wouldn't spend money on herself. She'd spend money on the kids, but they weren't extravagant or anything like that. So I've kind of been brought up, you know, learning the value of money. I've had a job since I was 15. I especially when you're 15, 16, 17, and it takes you a whole day and you can only work for one day to earn 25 quid, and you don't want to go out and have to get a taxi home and that's all your money gone. So I'm quite careful in that respect.
And in terms of how you look for the future and invest for the future, have you started to think about that? Have you got a plan?
Oh,
because the people that you went to university with, as you just mentioned, lots of them must work in the financial industry. You nearly went down that road. So would you take advice from friends, or do you kind of, how do you work out
people,
your strategy?
I think people you meet along the way, friends in the industry as well, because it's such a specialist, it's just a different situation to the majority of my friends from school and uni. And I think, you know, seeing my dad's pension be, you know, get wiped out years ago. I mean, he's very, very financially astute. He was an internal auditor, so he's way well on top of all this stuff. But, you know, with the credit crunch, even the best financial planners saw their money kind of, you know, a lot of it evaporate. So I think property, potentially one day, is going to be kind of a more stable route, I would hope.
You're talking about investing in property. Are there other things that you invest in as well?
Bits and pieces. It's kind of more small fry, more dabbling, more, you know, trying to find my footing in that kind of thing, and getting all the way down the pension route, and then making other decisions as COVID hits and as finances change. But I think I think for me, I think if I can, I think property is probably going to be the nest egg for the future. And, you know, thinking ahead to the girls, something to pass on, hopefully.
I know your girls are really little, so I'm hoping they don't have pocket money because they can't really spend it at the moment. But I mean, you never know. You might be giving them chores to do. They will get a bit older and they'll start being very useful, Rachel, let me tell you. There's all kinds of things kids can do, emptying the dishwasher, you know, taking the rubbish out. So have you got an idea in your own mind, or what was your experience as a child? And would you use that experience to kind of have a pocket money strategy for them?
Yeah, I'd like to. I mean, I've got a strong foundation with money. I know the value of it and I had to earn it. And I remember, you know, talking of education as well, my mum would give me, I think it was like £1 per A at the end of the year. And I really looked forward to that. And that was kind of, you know, money in my pocket for having done something good. And I want to instill that in the girls for sure. And I think having a job since I was 15 as well, you just learn the value of money. So now I think I've got more money than my parents had growing up. And, we're a bit more, especially Pasha's a bit more loose with the spending than I might be. So I think, there'll definitely be some kind of structure to earn, you know, to learn the value of a penny, because you have to work for it, don't you? And you can only spend it once. And I think it's a really important lesson that you have to learn early to see through to a competent adult financially.
Yeah, and it's very different when it's their money they're spending. I took my daughter shopping one day and she had some birthday money and she agonised over an item in Topshop for hours because it was her money that she was parting with. Whereas if I was buying it, it would have been at the till. We'd been out the shop. But it was really interesting watching her mindset shift suddenly and the decisions that had to be made. So it is really, I think, really useful. It's interesting what you say about Pasha there. If there's one of you then that's going to make an impulse buy, it would be him, would it?
He was brought up just differently. So he came from Soviet Russia. So when he was born, you know, they lived in a flat with no running water and an outside toilet, and it got down to minus 30, minus 40 degrees in the winter. And there wasn't the money around. There wasn't things to buy either. And I think going from that to suddenly being, you know, on So You Think You Can Dance and then Strictly Come Dancing, he's just got a different relationship with money. So it's a little bit more like easy come, easy go. And he's, because he didn't, you know, have from an early age going out and having a job or pocket money, there just wasn't that available. He's not as forward thinking. He's quite comfortable spending his money and then waiting for the next thing to come in. Whereas I could never, ever, ever spend all my money. I would have a heart attack. You know, I need to have like backup and plans and things like that. So we're very different. So I'll be trying to get in there early with the girls to have my influence rather than his. But looking at me and my brother and the differences between us, we might have one of each, who knows?
And then obviously you'll listen to advice from people that you trust around you. It sounds like your dad's pretty canny.
My dad's good. And you know, and like I say, people in the industry who shall remain nameless, who've just got good contacts, who know how to work, you know, slightly outside the box, slightly off the high street, off, you know, different options that would suit us better. And I'm definitely,
because Pasha obviously is the same. He's in the same industry.
He's not a UK citizen either. So he's kind of come over from the States. He's actually an American and a Russian citizen. So it gets even more complicated when you look at that side of things, because it's not straightforward. British, you know, even in terms of inheritance for the children, I think if Pasha were to get half, then he'd have to pay tax in the American system. But, you know, it just gets more and more complicated, unfortunately. So we're in a bit of a tangled financial situation and you need expert advice. And I think, you know, however numerate you are, you still need to ask the experts and then use your gut and use your, you know, risk aversion, comfort levels to make your own decisions.
And how do you keep on top? Is it like training to be an athlete when you're the countdown maths person? Do you have to keep doing stuff all the time, or is the show enough to keep that kind of speed?
I used to practice all the time. There's an app that one of our former contestants designed where you can go online and you can literally play in pretty much any language you want, and you can sit and you can play countdown numbers games with, you know, 3 seconds to look at it, or even a split second and it goes, and all these variants. And I used to play those all the time, but now it's kind of a bit more embedded. I think I've done over 3,000 shows, plus, you know, a couple of hundred cats.
So you must have had the same numbers come up again. Oh, who knows?
With the same... I used to beat myself up if I didn't get the numbers game as well. I'd, you know, I'd be really cross with myself. And now I think hopefully I've proved my worth. And I wouldn't let anyone ever tell me even a hint of how the answer it should go if I miss it. But I don't, you know, take it home and cry if I miss one.
But do you also kind of sometimes go, yeah, well done, Rachel. That was pretty good.
Yeah,
that was
there are. Good I still, there. I'm still like, a massive loser. Like sometimes if I know that it's a really good solution, my heart will kind of go while I'm writing it up. I'm trying to. It's ridiculous. That's how much of a geek I am in terms of the numbers. Because you know, some of them are really easy. Some of them are. There's only one solution, and you know, some app will tell you some. There's a random percentage. It's 97% difficult, wherever they've got that figure from. But yeah, there are occasionally ones where I just think, ah, that's good. I'm going to remember that one.
And so your book, tell me a little bit about it and why I should buy a copy and what it'll do for me.
It's aimed at adults and it's aimed at anyone who needs a bit of a helping hand when it comes to maths. And I was inspired to write it because people often send me on social media, they send me their kids' maths homework questions or, you know.
Like, what, are you supposed to do that for free?
I know, I love it. I really like it. And I used to, you know, even from school, I used to help my friends because, you know, I was always that one in the class and like, Rach, how do I do this? How does this work? Or the teacher would use my answers as the marking sheet. I was always a geek. But I really enjoy it. And I find like the buzz of helping other people as well because it's just the right way of thinking about things and something can be unlocked. And one of the most frequent things that people tell me about their maths from school is, I don't remember how to work out a percentage. I don't remember the formula for. And for me, it's not about remembering anything. That's one of the things I love about maths. It's about working things out. And if you have the fundamentals, if you have the basics, if you understand where these things have arisen from, then there's nothing to forget because it's something that you can work out for yourself and it allows you to use those tools to solve real world problems, whether that's in your financial planning or your kids' homework or, you know, like I say, decorating your bathroom. You can use those mathematical skills in a helpful, realistic way. So I'm hoping this book will do that.
And let's be honest, Rachel, you writing this book means that you don't have to answer people on social media all the time. You just say, look, just go read the book, all right? And it saves you a lot of time.
Well, I enjoy it. I said it's something called nerd whacking. And people stand outside like MIT with a problem on a piece of, you know, cardboard. And people like me just have to solve these things. And it's really just distracting. And my friend that sent this question of the day, I was about to drive off, you know, drive home from shopping. And I just had to sit there in the car and give them the answer and work it out because I'm a nerd.
So who was it that helped you to kind of believe that you could be a woman mathematician and be great at it?
Well, I was really lucky in that I think I won my first prize for being clever. You know, that's how I took it when I was about 5 or 6. And before that, I had no concept of if I was doing well. I didn't know that anyone was looking or measuring or anything. And then I won a prize and was like, oh, this is quite nice. Quite like this. And then growing up, I went to an all-girls grammar school and we had a headmistress who, it wasn't even a question of boys being better than girls. It wasn't a question. It wasn't on our radars that there was a difference. It wouldn't have even crossed our minds. So it wasn't until I got to uni and you get a few boys there thinking that they're better than you. Where have you got this idea from? Not familiar with this. I think it's rubbish. But now, you know, trying to be an ambassador as such and trying to go in and encourage girls and encourage whoever from whatever backgrounds to get into maths and STEM and tell them they can do it. You know, I've seen that actually, you know, from the age of 5, girls start to believe that brilliant is a male trait. And if you don't think you're as good as someone else at a particular subject, you're probably less likely to go on and study it to a higher level. So I think there's, you know, so much work to be done that's really easy work in terms of psychology and the way we talk about maths and you know, having it as a more of a positive thing in this country rather than a badge of honour to say I'm rubbish at it. That's my drum banged.
Yeah, what you do in that area is so important. And I love when you are, you know, kind of banging that drum because I saw it with my own daughter when she was about 10. She literally was crying, well, didn't ever want to do maths again, had a teacher that told her she was really rubbish at it. And even on parents' evening, this teacher went bright red with fury and she was in the 5th set of 5. And by the time she got to do her GCSE, she was doing further maths, and she was nearly doing maths A-level, you know, because at the age of 13, she happened upon an incredible teacher. And I remember thinking, what is this teacher doing? What's happened to my daughter? She loves maths. And so I went to parents' evening, and this woman was incredible. She had 9 kids of her own, right? So first of all, this woman's got incredible patience. And, and I said, thank you so much, whatever you've done. And she just looked at me really kind of matter-of-fact and went, maths is great.
I love that. And the resilience your daughter must have to ignore that first teacher. I think it is all about that one inspiring teacher. And when I was at school, I was the only person doing further maths. I was the only one doing it. And then a new head of maths came in, Sarah Inbush, who was working in the city, got disillusioned with working in the city, went and became a maths teacher. And a couple of years later, she had 30 girls doing further maths A-level out of 150 in the year. I mean, it just shows what a difference that one person can make, and one person believing in you can make to someone's life. And she's got these girls, you know, going online and helping all the neighbouring schools and the younger kids. And that, you know, not only helps them, but it cements the ideas in your own mind as well. So it's just that one inspirational teacher, or that, you know, that one person who believes in you. And contrary to that, that one awful person who tells you you're rubbish. Why? What are they thinking? Why have you gone into teaching if you want to discourage kids? I don't get it.
And what are you going to, where are you, is that ever going to help anybody? Just, you know, giving them such, because it became, you could see the physical shutter, the shutters came down, you know, and there was an absolute block in terms of belief. And that applies to any subject and any area of life, doesn't it? That, you know, how your words can make such an impact. But you're absolutely not that person. And good luck with the book. and good luck, of course, with the babies. You're talking to us while you've got two children still technically under, well, you've got a 1-year-old and a baby, so, and you're managing to do this, so very well done on juggling, the juggle as well,
juggling. thankfully not literally juggling, but
obviously it takes a team, doesn't it? It takes a village to bring a baby. I always remember
it,
that
doesn't it just thanks Pasha, thanks to his mother as well. Mother-in-laws, Russian mother-in-laws, it's the way forward.
Are they called babushkas or
she's babushka, yeah,
babushka. Lovely to have one in your house.
Brilliant.
Lovely to chat, Rachel, thank you so much, best of luck with everything.
Thank you very much, thanks for having me.
Well, it's time for our AI expert slot, and Moira O'Neill, Head of Personal Finance, joins us now. Hi, Moira.
Hi, Gabby.
Obviously, Rachel has an incredible brain for figures and numbers, and it's an absolute joy to her, isn't it, just to spend an evening doing some equations. Not everybody is quite so confident, are they? And if you're looking to get involved in DIY investing for the first time, what are the key numbers that you need to consider when you're looking at any investment?
Okay, well, maths is so important, and our research has shown that half of the population don't understand the compounding of investments, and the how fees that relate to investments can mount up. So even very small amounts, so say you think you're paying half a percentage on your investments, and people don't realise that on £50,000 that can amount to £250 in fees a year. But also things like that, when it feels like it's a very small amount that you're paying on your investments, over a long period, so 10, 20, even 30 years, those very, very small things that drip out of your investments every year can mount up to really huge amounts when you come to retire, or you come to realise your money that's grown over the years. And so it's very, very important for us as investors to make sure that we keep an eye on charges. And it's much more important than a lot of people think. But likewise, you know, the power of compound interest is something I think is a great bit of maths that should be taught to everybody, because that is how even small amounts of investments that you put aside on a regular basis can mount up to substantial amounts over many years. And I think people often put off investing because they don't realise this immense power that they have. So even if you're putting aside £25 a month, incrementally over years it can grow and grow and grow and compound up. There's another great maths lesson, Gabby, which is all about Jack and Jill. So this is about the importance of starting investing early. So Jill, the sensible one, starts investing at age 20 and invests the same amount up to every month up to the age of 40, and then she stops investing. Jack, who's not as sensible and not as knowledgeable, starts investing at 40 and finishes at 60. And they've both effectively put aside the same amount of money. But Jill does so much better because she started early. Even small amounts invested between the ages of 20 and 40 can stand you in such good stead for retirement. I think that's a lesson that should be taught in all schools.
It's so hard, isn't it, for young people to kind of get their head around that, because especially when it's your first salary, your first income, you know, real income that you've ever earned apart from weekend jobs, and the idea of giving some of it to, you know, kind of a hole somewhere that you're not going to see for a long time is, for young people, I think it's getting your head around that. But as you say, if the education comes in earlier and it's not something that comes as a surprise in your mid-20s, it just might be conditioning people to get ready for that. Maybe it's cultural almost.
Absolutely. As soon as that people start their first jobs, they'll be offered to join the pension scheme. And that's a really important thing to do, because not only are you starting putting money aside for a secure future, you're also getting free money from the government. You're getting tax relief on your contributions. And the maths behind that is amazing too. I mean, if you don't take advantage of that and potentially employer contributions on top of that as well, then you're really throwing money away, and you're throwing all the compounding that you can get on those small contributions at the start of your career. You're throwing all of that away over the years too.
Yeah, and obviously people don't get that kind of investment education at school, do they? So where can people go? Where can they kind of increase their knowledge in this area?
Well, some teachers in schools are doing amazing jobs with teaching basic personal finance and money lessons to kids, even starting in primary school. And we know this because we run a Teacher of the Year award relating to personal finance. So we see some of the amazing entries that they do. They teach children about wants and needs and the difference. And they teach kids to budget. They sometimes introduce a currency within the school so kids can learn to use the shop, etc. And teenagers are taught amazing things about the stock market in some schools, but it's not there firmly embedded into the national curriculum. So teachers are struggling across the country to deliver this kind of education. And our research has shown that investors and older members of the family really want to pass on those financial money skills to younger members of their family. They think it's more important to deliver financial education than it is to actually pass on real money, real wealth to your children. And I think that's really a great thing, you know. So older investors mentoring younger members of their family or their friends to start investing is a thing that they want to do. And so as a result, Interactive Investor has introduced Friends and Family. So that's a product that for an extra £5 a month, you can gift the gift of free investing to five people. And it's backed up by a huge amount of education. So we've developed a lesson plan to help you get started investing. It's based around video, a few articles, nothing that's too challenging. I know Rachel talked a lot about wanting to take professional advice. You don't have to do that. You can learn very simple things that can stand you in good stead and can help you achieve amazing financial goals. There are some simple things you can do. You can learn about funds and investment trusts, for example, and that's probably all you need to know. And we can teach you ways to identify good investments too.
Thanks for listening. If you have time, please like and follow the II Family Money Show and leave us a review or rating in your podcast app. You can find loads of ideas on how to plan for you and your family's future at ii.co.uk. I'll see you next time.